please join me in welcoming to the stage Hillary Rodham Clinton.
This is great being back here. I really thank you for that extraordinary warm welcome. I am thrilled to be here and to have a chance to make a few remarks and then to have a conversation with Anne. Those of you who follow her on radio or maybe saw her TED Talk, know that she is an expert in the English language. That is a little bit daunting, but I will do my very best. You know, I couldn't help but think, as I was on my way here, that I've had a lot of truly special moments in Michigan over many, many years. Just in the 2016 election, I had the chance in Detroit to celebrate businesses like Shinola that are creating jobs and new opportunity in America. I remember visiting Futuramic in Warren, a former auto manufacturing plant, where I got to talk with workers helping to build a rocket that would go literally from Macomb to Mars. And I heard directly from President Obama that his campaign stop here in Ann Arbor was really one for the history books. So I am deeply grateful for the support I received in Michigan, and I want to give a special shout out to the Hillary Clinton fan club. For those of you who don't know, this group started back in the early 90s, right in the beginning of my husband's first term. And I have so enjoyed coming to Ann Arbor and meeting them over the years, getting letters from them. And I was sort of reminiscing, looking at, you know, some of the pictures that we have from those gatherings. And look, the outcome in Michigan was not what I hoped or worked for. Let me just tell you that. But I want today, as I talk about the book I wrote, to really urge everyone, do not grow weary. We have a lot of work to do to stand up for the values that we share and the causes we believe in. That is more important now here in Michigan and across America than it's ever been. So now, I'm really glad to be here to talk about what happened. As I write in the book, you know, in the past, I really did feel like I had to be careful in public and, you know, pretty much keep my guard up. Well, those days are over, my friends. And what I try to do is pull back the curtain on one of the wildest elections in American history. I do talk about some of the moments that still frustrate me, including in a chapter called Those Damn Emails. But I also talk about moments I will remember forever, like the way it felt to stand on the stage in Philadelphia to accept the Democratic Party's nomination for president. Or even the final whirlwind swing of the campaign, including an exhilarating rally in Grand Rapids, where I talked about my vision to get the economy working for everybody, not just those at the top. So I'm really still proud of the campaign we ran and the 65.8 million Americans who supported it. And yes, writing this book was sometimes a very painful process. It turned out to be cathartic for me and ultimately reinvigorating because as a person, when people ask me how I am, I say, I'm okay. But as an American, I'm really concerned. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because it's as much about the future as the past. And I think there are lessons that apply to everyone, either in a personal or a political way. And I want to touch briefly on four tonight. First, everyone gets knocked down. Like, on trips, like I was in London, and walking down a flight of stairs, trying to drink a cup of coffee, carry on a conversation at the same time, wearing heels. Well, it didn't work out so well for me, but what matters is whether you get back up and keep going. And since Election Day, one of the most common questions I get asked is, how did you even get out of bed? And I'll admit, as I write in the book, there were times when I was very tempted just to pull the covers up over my head. But instead, I did spend time with friends and family. I read a lot, especially mystery novels that, you know, have an ending that usually is good. The bad guy gets comeuppance, you know. So I watched HGTV. I went into a frenzy of organizing and cleaning closets. I played with my dogs. I did some yoga, including alternate nostril breathing, which I highly recommend. And yes, I had my fair share of Chardonnay, so. I also started a new organization called Onward Together to encourage the outpouring of activism and engagement that we're seeing right now. Now, nothing makes me feel better than channeling my frustrations into action, and I hope many of you have come to the same conclusion because our future depends on it. And here in Michigan, you know a little something about resilience from the revival of the American auto industry to right here in Ann Arbor, where innovation is on the rise at high-tech firms and research labs. So we've got to keep going, but we also have to remember those who are being left behind. That's why I talk about Flint and coming to meet with Mayor Weaver and families whose children had been drinking and bathing in poison water. You know, those families still face very difficult circumstances. The lead levels in the water are going down, which is encouraging, but it could still be a year or more before people can drink from their faucets. It's just heartbreaking and outrageous. This is not something that should ever happen in America, period. And six officials of the state, including the head of Michigan's health department, have been charged with involuntary manslaughter. And we know that, you know, there are still problems with the school, there aren't enough jobs, too many children are not given the health care and nutrition they need. So we've got to stay focused, both on what we can do to accelerate and make exciting the future, but also to try to provide as much help as possible, because we know that what happened in Flint wouldn't happen in an affluent community. We're seeing the same thing happen right now in Puerto Rico, aren't we? Where we've got the same kind of problems, and we need to pay attention to them. And I thank the determination of families in Flint and the mayor and activists and others who refuse to stop speaking out, and the rest of us should be doing what we can to help. So it's not only about what we need to do in politics, although I'll say more about that in the conversation, that's really key. It's also about what we can do on a personal level. The second lesson is this. The only way we will get sexism out of politics is to get more women into politics. And, you know, I've really tried to take on the endemic sexism and misogyny in our society, and in a chapter called On Being a Woman in Politics, address, you know, some of the experiences that I and other women in the public arena have had. But it's deeper and broader than that. You know, the research is pretty clear. For men, likability and professional success go hand in hand. In other words, the more successful a man becomes, the more people like him. But with women, it's the exact opposite. The more professionally successful we are, the less people like us. And maybe some of you in this room have an inkling about what I'm discussing here. And I would add that not only that, women are seen favorably when we advocate for others, but unfavorably when we advocate for ourselves. And that really struck a chord with me, as I explain in the book, because historically, people like me when I'm in a supporting role. Think about it. You know, serving as First Lady, serving the people of New York, in the Senate, serving as President Obama's Secretary of State. When I left the State Department, my favorability was 69%. Now, but when a woman steps forward and says, now I'd like a chance to lead, everything changes. And I can't think of a single woman in politics who doesn't have stories to tell, not one, on every level, federal, state, local. So yes, there are plenty of reasons why being a woman in politics can be downright infuriating, but it can also be deeply rewarding. You know, just by being at the table, you're bringing a perspective that might otherwise never be mentioned. So I hope women of all ages will read this book and be inspired to run for office, to compete, to get into the public arena. And I intend to do everything I can to help. Now, the third lesson of this book is also one that's very close to my heart. There is no such thing as an alternative fact. And obviously, I've given a lot of thought to this since the election. Because the Russian disinformation campaign during the 2016 election was successful in part because America's natural defenses had been worn down over years by powerful interests and voices that wanted to make it harder to distinguish between fact and fiction. When leaders deny things, we can see with our own eyes, like the size of a crowd at the inauguration, or when they refuse to accept settled science when it comes to urgent challenges like climate change, it is not just frustrating to everyone who prides ourselves on living in the fact-based universe. It is insidious, and it is subversive to democracy. And one of the points I make in the book is how essential it is at places like this great university, but in our everyday lives, to stand up for facts and evidence, to demand proof, to try to figure out the best we can to come to decisions that are rooted in reason. Now, The fourth and final lesson I want to mention is this. The forces at work in the 2016 election are still with us. Now, that was a perfect storm. Deep currents of anger and resentment flowing through our culture. A political press that told voters my emails were the most important story. The unprecedented intervention in our election by the director of the FBI. And the information warfare waged against us from the Kremlin. Now, what we've learned about Russian interference in the election is more than alarming. It's a clear and present danger to Western democracy, and it is right out of Vladimir Putin's playbook. Here's some of what we already know. We know that Russian agents used Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, even Pinterest to place targeted attack ads and negative stories intended not only to lie about me and to hurt me with voters, but to fan the flames of division within American society. Russians posed as Americans. They pretended to be LGBT activists, gun rights activists. They even held phony demonstrations. And what's more, the propaganda was aimed directly at undecided voters, so-called soft Clinton supporters, who might be persuaded to back a third-party candidate or not vote at all. In fact, we learned recently that some of those Facebook ads specifically targeted voters in Michigan and Wisconsin. One study found that here in Michigan, nearly half of all political news on Twitter in the final days before the election was false or misleading propaganda. You all probably know somebody who saw it and thought, well, gosh, I can't vote for her. Facebook is now the biggest news platform in the world. So if something comes up in your feed, you read it. You pay attention to it. The Russians knew that. The Trump campaign knew that. But this isn't just about what happened. It's about what's happening right now. The Russians are still playing on anything and everything they can to turn Americans against each other. So this is bigger than one candidate, one election, or even one country. Now, I was encouraged that a few months ago, over the president's objections, Congress passed bipartisan legislation to ratchet up sanctions against Russia because of their interference in our election. And earlier this month, Senator McCain rightly took the president to task for missing key deadlines in implementing those sanctions and failing to enforce the law. Even Attorney General Sessions himself says the administration is doing virtually nothing to prevent future attacks. I don't care whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, I don't care. If you are an American, this should alarm you. It is shameful. The president swore an oath to faithfully execute the law and defend our Constitution, and he should start doing his job. And the rest of us have to keep up the pressure. No foreign power in modern history has attacked us with so few consequences. And that puts us all at risk. Russia's weapons of choice may not be tanks or missiles, but let's not mince words. This is a new kind of Cold War, and it is just getting started. So where do we go from here? Now, I don't have all the answers, but I wrote this book in part to lay out some of the questions, to provide my best understanding, and to really provoke a debate. I know when it comes to Russia, we've got to get serious about cybersecurity, get tough with Putin, and get to the bottom of what really happened in 2016. And beyond that, we must insist on truth and accuracy and hold elected leaders and the press accountable when they fail to meet that standard. We also must refuse to be silent in the face of racism, sexism, bigotry, or rhetoric intended to incite hate and violence. And we must summon the courage to stand up for human rights and democracy. And most of all, we must vote in every election. Everybody in Michigan knows every vote matters, and we can't take anything for granted. And I know there are some people who think, okay, the election's over, let's move on. Well, I'm here to tell you, we cannot just move on. We have to learn these lessons because they will help us determine whether we can protect democracy here or anywhere in the world, because these are not one-off events. There are forces at work that will continue to fight against freedom, against democracy, against human rights, LGBT rights, civil rights, women's rights, every value that we hold dear. So I'm going to do everything I can to keep going forward as a citizen, speaking out, and I'm not going anywhere except right into the middle of the debate about our future. Thank you.